The American consumer exceeds expectations.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, welcome to the Morning Open. I'm Bill Radke. Some of the big retailers are reporting March sales this morning, and it was a relatively happy Easter. We'll get to that in a moment. First, the stock market is 20 minutes into its day. Where's Wall Street? Well, the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ are off about 0.5% this morning, and the Dow is down 40 points, keeps backing away, way away from 11,000. It's at 10,856 now. European stocks are also down about 1%. Greek debt is another concern today. Bank stocks in Greece tumbled this morning, and Asian shares were down as well. Let's say good morning to Chief Economist Diane Swonk at Mesirow Financial. Even on her birthday, she makes time to join us live from Chicago. Thanks, Diane.
Thank you.
This morning's sales figures include Target, Costco, limited brands, some big ones. What is your take?
Well, we're seeing very strong year-over-year gains, and the main reason for that is last year was abysmal, and we're now coming out of it. We also had a late Easter, which helped out boost sales a bit. But in the grand scheme of things, overall consumer spending is still very muted given the depth of the losses we've endured.
Well, you can see why we would mute our spending since we're in debt and out of jobs. But, Diane, I wonder if you think this frugality is a long-term change for Americans or a passing thing?
Well, you know, it would be a passing thing if we could get our hands on some credit again, but that's not going to happen. In fact, credit continues to contract, and it gets harder and harder for consumers to get access to credit, so we no longer can live beyond our means. So this is a long-term restructuring of the U.S. economy.
One other subject, Diane, on jobs. This morning, the government said new claims for unemployment benefits rose again last week. I thought companies were beginning to hire again.
Yeah, they're beginning to hire, but awfully slowly, isn't it? It's more of a dribble than an actual flood of jobs out there. And we could use a flood. We need a lot of water. We're in a drought. And so I think the reality is that we're still in a very fragile recovery, a recovery that has been going on for about 9 months, but much like the expectant mother waiting for the baby to come, Main Street's still waiting to see it.
Diane Swonk at Mesirow Financial, have a great birthday.
Thank you.
On Capitol Hill right now, a senior advisor to Citigroup, former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin, is testifying to the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Rubin told the commission he did not know early on that Citigroup had $43 billion in high-risk securities in its accounts.
The board required and received extensive financial and risk reporting. But I do not recall knowing before September 07 that these super senior tranches were on our books.
The commission is looking into Citigroup's role in spreading high-risk mortgage debt through the financial system. Meanwhile, the current Treasury Secretary, Timothy Geithner, he's in Beijing today for talks with one of China's top economic aides. Now, climate change might come up in the discussion, Iran, North Korea, but most observers say the meeting's real focus is currency. From Shanghai, Bill Marcus has that story.
Timothy Geithner's agenda in China hasn't been released. In fact, it's unknown if it's even been finalized, considering China's surprise invitation to the U.S. Treasury Secretary was only just announced yesterday. But the high-level talks between finance officials suggest that China's monetary policy is on the docket. Experts say don't expect anything radical as a result of the meeting. A key Bank of China advisor today expressly recommended against any sharp rise. Tom Miller is an economist with Dragonomics.
I don't think it presages that there's going to be a sudden move in the renminbi. I think it's a sign that the U.S. and China are talking to one another, and that's very positive, but I don't think it's anything to be desperately excited about.
Many think that the talking is directly related to the decision made over the weekend by the Obama administration to delay a high-stakes report that could have labeled Beijing a currency manipulator. Others say that China wants the yuan to appreciate, as long as it looks like they're not pressured into it. In Shanghai, I'm Bill Marcus for Marketplace.
This is the Morning Report for Thursday, April 8th at Marketplace.org. Sources say United Airlines and U.S. Airways are talking about a merger. The combination of those two would create the second biggest airline in the country. And with more, here's Marketplace's Amy Scott. Hi, Amy.
Good morning.
Why would these two airlines want to merge?
Well, the airline business is hurting from high fuel costs and, of course, fewer people flying because of the recession. In fact, today, two other airlines, British Airways and Spain's Iberia, signed a deal to create the world's third largest airline. You know, the industry lost $11 billion last year, and merging is one way to save money by cutting overlapping flights and jobs. But, of course, that often means layoffs.
And what about for passengers, Amy? Are we going to end up paying more to fly?
That's definitely a concern when you have fewer airlines out there competing for your business. But I spoke this morning with Mark Pilling, who edits Airline Business Magazine, and he's not too worried about that.
There's still a lot of competition in this market, and I think that there will always be the case. Yeah, there are certain routes that would suffer, you know, inevitably. But this is what regulators are for. They're meant to look at these things and see, you know, what remedies might be put in place.
And, of course, antitrust regulators would have to sign off on this deal if it happens. But United and U.S. Airways have talked about pairing off before, and it hasn't happened. And these latest talks are still reportedly in the early stages. So this time it could fall through, too.
Okay. Marketplace's Amy Scott. Amy, thank you.
You're welcome.
Even though companies are starting to hire again, there are still about five times as many people looking for work as there are jobs to fill. But what if I told you that by 2018, there could be more jobs than job seekers? Actually, what if our economics editor, Chris Farrell, told you that? Good morning.
Good morning, Bill.
Doesn't sound right, Chris. What's gotten into you?
Well, I've been bitten by the demographic bug. Now, baby boomers are getting older. The oldest boomers will start getting Medicare next year.
Granted, but is that alone, Chris, enough to take us from not enough jobs to too many?
Well, according to two economists, Barry Bluestone, Mark Melnick, and Northeastern University, now, they use a very simple economic model. The economy is going to recover. And then they assume that older workers will continue to retire at their normal retirement age, and we have no major change in immigration policy. And then they take into account that there's a baby bust generation. So there's going to be a gap of about 5 million jobs. 30 to 40% of the jobs that could be created from 2008 to 2018 could go begging.
30 to 40%. Does that mean that wages then have to rise enough to lure grandma and grandpa back to work?
Oh, you would think so. That'd be the smart thing to do, right? But companies hate paying more. Now, they could also change immigration policy. I don't see that happening. You could do some more offshoring. You know, there are limits to that. No, I think what they're going to do is say to grandma and grandpa, we're not going to pay you more, but we're going to change our benefit policy. You know, with young parents, we have maternity leave. When you have a grandchild born, we'll give you leave.
Interesting. Now, Chris, I could be wrong here, but I think of younger workers as being the innovators in our economy. Can our economy thrive with an older workforce?
Our economy can thrive and be even more productive. Look, this isn't a story of no young workers. We're going to have plenty of young workers and lots of immigrants that are hustling to make a better life for themselves and their children. But older workers have knowledge, they have experience, and they're going to continue to share what they have learned over the years, and that's going to help out as companies navigate business cycles and competition from other nations.
Okay. Our wise, experienced, yet dynamic economics editor, Chris Farrell. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
Well, we've all heard by now that Tiger Woods steps back onto the links today for the first time since his scandal broke. It is the Masters Tournament, and Nancy Fergali takes a look at whether Woods' return can get the business of golf out of the rough.
Tiger's return should boost TV ratings for the Masters by double digits. Sponsors are happy, and so is the PGA, for now anyway. Bob Dorfman is the author of the Sports Marketer Scouting Report. He says the scandal should make the PGA realize it can't only rely on Tiger Woods to promote professional golf.
It's very difficult for them to do otherwise, given the success and popularity of Tiger Woods.
Case in point, prize money for golfers has increased by more than 100% since Woods joined the tour. Other golfers probably won't ever have the same pull, but Dorfman says the tour needs to promote other players.
They learn that they can't put all their eggs in one basket.
And Wood's return can't fix an emerging financial problem for the PGA, the drop in sponsors because of the recession. The usual companies that support PGA events, like automakers and financial services firms, have cut their underwriting budgets. This year, 10 sponsorship deals are set to expire for the PGA.
The economic downturn obviously has hurt a lot of their sponsorship opportunities. I know they're talking about, you know, even opening up sponsorships to distillers and possibly gambling, you know, casinos. So it may be a little bit more wide open.
Already, the PGA is looking to expand its brand overseas with tournaments in Europe and Asia. I'm Nancy Fergali for Marketplace.
KFC has a bucket of trouble over its paper packaging. Environmentalists are accusing the chicken chain of helping to destroy forests in the southern United States. We get more from Sarah Gardner from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
A southern conservation group called the Dogwood Alliance says it's tried to meet with KFC over where it gets its paper products, but to no avail. So today it's turning up the heat with a national media campaign dubbed Kentucky Fried Forests. Dogwood's even using an image of the colonel brandishing a chainsaw.
KFC's paper packaging for their buckets, napkins, bags, cups, it's all coming from destroyed forests.
That's Dogwood's Dana Smith. Her group wants KFC to stop getting their paper from pine plantations and clear-cut forests. Dogwood launched a similar campaign against Staples in 2000 and succeeded. Fast food analyst Darren Tristano at Technomic expects KFC will reconsider its paper sourcing and recycled content.
However, in this economy, we're very much looking at how to save costs, not exactly looking at how to improve the environment.
KFC declined to comment on tape, but its website says much of its paper products come from forests certified by the Sustainable Forestry Initiative, a standard some conservationists consider too lax. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
And finally, the New York Times reports states are cutting their budget deficits by thinning out a tangle of advisory commissions. So Washington State's Special License Plate Review Board was not special enough to survive. The Connecticut Advisory Commission on American and Francophone Cultural Affairs will have to bid adieu. And Iowa cut out its Grape and Wine Development Commission. Too bad. Maybe they could merge with the abandoned Francophones of Connecticut. This is the Marketplace Morning Report. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.